Love this podcast? Support this show through the supporter feature from Acast. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Dedicated to Henry Foreman. In the year of the primal form, the dawn of terrestrial birth, man mastered the mammoth and horse, and man was the lord of the earth. He made him an olive skin from the heart of an olive tree. He compassed the earth therein, and man was the lord of the sea. He controlled the vigorous steam, he harnessed the lightning for hire, he drove the celestial team, and man was the lord.
Well, well, well. Good evening. Good afternoon. How the hell are you doing? This is Alan Averill. This is Agitators Anonymous. This will be episode 50-something, which we all will be soon enough. 57, I think. This is an episode that came out as a debate on my YouTube channel only earlier in the week. It didn't coincide with the release of this on the Saturday, which is the Great Death Metal Debate, I titled it. There's going to be a few of those. I'm going to do a few other debates with random people. Didn't quite fit into the Agitators Anonymous rubric on the YouTube channel, but it does on the podcast. So if you don't feel like nerding out with two other metal nerds talking about death metal from 30 years ago, maybe, you know, this one ain't for you. But there will be more history, politics, culture, and all that kind of stuff coming up soon. But here we are. Right. The Great Death Metal Debate. This is something that me and Jason did a couple of years ago. Well, several times. A couple of years ago over a few beers. Nerded out, arguing about death metal. That kind of thing. I was from more the Studs and Satan angle. He was from the more the kind of Napalm Death cargo shorty grinding attitude of death metal. And so a small little piece in his book, Extremity Retained, appeared, which was me and Paul from Primordial drunkenly mainly talking about street violence. It's a bit incoherent. So hopefully this podcast will sort of make slight amends for that miserly little input that happened many, many years ago. So it's just two dudes nerding out about death metal. What can I say other than that? Right. Let's get through the sponsors. We have a new sponsor. It's Eisenwald Records, one of the brightest, most, I suppose, biggest up-and-coming new label when it comes to dark and black metal. Go to www.eisentonde or .com for North American and European stores. Put in the promo code ALA and you'll get 10% off. And that's also to up-and-coming bands, Wada, Ungfell, Panzerfaust, all this kind of stuff. Check it out. www.metalblade.com in North America. Put in the promo code AA podcast and you'll get 10% off. Cannibal Corpse, 6 Feet Under, Fate's Warning, Slayer, all that kind of stuff. In fact, there's a Spotify playlist to go with this special chat curated by myself and Jason. It's just called Death Metal 91. You can put it in and find it on Spotify, no problem. And it's got lots of bands on there from all sorts of the labels, especially Metal Blade, we're talking about Cannibal and stuff. Go and check it out. And finally, www.hatecouture, H-A-T-E, as in hate, C-O-U-T-U-R-E, 616.com, hateful yet tasteful apparel and clothing, serial killers, tyrants, lots and lots of stuff that's going to piss off your friends, neighbours, loved ones, and unloved ones once lockdown ends, if it ever ends. Go there, put in ALAN, and you will get free shipping. And I can tell you what, seeing as I've been shipping out Dread Sovereign records and CDs and T-shirts for the last while, I would also tell you, go and have a look at our Bandcamp. Lots of new merch coming. Shipping is getting crazy out there. Anyway. Whatever, who cares? Extremity retained. This is the death metal debate between me and Jason from Misery Index. So, it didn't come out on the YouTube channel, as I said, under Agitators Anonymous. I'm going to do a bunch of these debates kind of things as well as other stuff. So go over and take a look on the YouTube channel and you'll see various other things in there. Call from the grave, all sorts of stuff. Right, right, right. Let's do it, Jason from Misery Index.
Which is, unfortunately, it's sold out right now.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, it sold out last year, and I have to press them more. But
All right, let's start at the start, Jason. Extremity retained. Seeing as we're going to have a discussion about death metal 30 years on from 1991 to now. I suppose if we were being very pedantic and dramatic about it, we might realize that this is 31 years, because you have your 1 year inclusive or something, don't you? But, well, let's not quibble about that. But so we discussed this, we had a kind of table discussion at some festival years and years ago before you wrote this book. But can you tell us what was the sort of notes from the underground? What was the reasons for kind of making, doing the book?
Well, at the time I started, I started in 2011 actually. And, and, you know, it was like right about that time. It was about the 20 year point from 1990, 91. And, you know, I started to see, you know, I was touring a lot with my band at the time, and end up backstage or on tour with people. And then you start hearing these stories going around backstage about old tours, about old studio experiences, about the way things used to be, sometimes waxing nostalgic, sometimes like, you know, I don't know, mythologizing or whatever about things. And you know, I looked at, just from a perspective, I just thought, you know, why, these are like great stories. Like, you know, and I thought about what had been written already. And for death metal, there was, you know, Albert Mudrian's book, Choosing Death. And there was, you know, a handful of other kind of like loosely related texts and some academic ones. And I just thought it would be fun to have like a book that was just like an oral history. You know, there's just like a collection of stories and like, you know, reminiscences and kind of, to paint a kind of like picture of the history in the words of those who lived through it and were present at the creation and experienced it and all that sort of thing. So I just, you know, since we were touring a lot, I took advantage of the time and you know, especially at festivals, as you know, you're kind of backstage and you're sitting there at a table having a beer, maybe playing later that night or the next day, and you look around and there's like a who's who with the metal scene usually. Sitting around there. So I was like, so I just, you know, I got a digital recorder, and over like 3 years or 2 or 3 years, I just started like compiling these stories and slowly put them together for the book. And then, you know, once I had all the stories, I kind of like, you know, you see these narratives start to come up, so you can kind of like make some kind of loose chapters out of it, you know, based on origin stories or studio stories or tour stories. And so I just kind of went with that. And yeah, it was actually came out in 2014. So it's going through a couple print runs. And as I mentioned earlier, it's out of print right now, unfortunately, but yeah, I'll try and get it back soon.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's how we started talking about this, was we kind of ended up at the same, I think, you know, sometimes you get paired for weekends with a band that you don't know, and you end up being in the same shuttle bus, same stage, same time, and you end up hanging out with them over like a weekend or two. And I think that's how we ended up starting to talk about this, because me and our bass player were discussing kind of like street violence in the old Irish death metal scene or something of 1991.
Yeah, I mean, of course, you don't have to be playing death metal to have those experiences or have lived those experiences and have something to contribute. So,
yeah.
I think it was like the one where we met was like one of those metal fests. I don't know if you were with Rock the Nation then.
I don't think so. But
it was Rock the Nation that it got us on, and we did like five shows and like one in each country that was like some.
Yeah, we did kind of like the two weekends or something, you know. But sometimes you get, you kind of get stuck in the same little porter cabin or whatever, you know.
Yep.
So the kind of premise of what we're discussing here was, it's really kind of 30 years since, I suppose, you could consider the heyday of death metal. I mean, I would agree with that. I was 15 or 16 then, and it was just like at the apex of, it was just hitting its apex right when I was about the most excited I could possibly be as a, you know, teenager, just pre-adult, just perfectly in that adolescent moment where you'd gone past Metallica and Slayer and all of a sudden you'd found Morbid Angel and Death and Deicide. And but you also got to see those bands in their prime and in their pomp, not now when they're in their mid-50s or whatever. Some of them still great, but to see Morbid Angel in 1991 was something else, I think, really, because that was right when they were hitting that right at the top. Like the way, you know, when you've spoken to somebody who said, oh, you should have seen Motorhead in 83 or Sabbath in 80 or whatever, and you're like, ah, yeah, okay. But that was the moment where it was perfectly placed in time. And Ireland was just starting to get, there was a couple of promoters who were bringing over death metal bands, and before they all moved into rave, because ecstasy culture kind of killed death metal in Ireland in 92. But for a while, between 89, 90 and 92, I mean, Morgoth, Carcass, Death, Morbid Angel, the gigs were just Deicide, just sort of endless. And it was just perfectly placed for a window of about 20 months. But what we're going to like try and have a look at is that moment. Like, you were in Maryland then, right?
Yeah.
And so
Washington, D.C., Baltimore kind of metropolitan area.
And you must have seen then some of the same bands obviously coming through at the same time.
Yeah, I saw Morbid Angel in 91 too with Entombed and Unleashed opening up.
Yeah, we got Unleashed, but we didn't get Entombed.
And Entombed, I don't think it was LG singing though. I think it might have been the Nirvana 2002 guy.
Or Var.
Remember his name? Okay, yeah.
Yeah.
I can't be sure because I was a little out of it at the time. And
yeah.
But it was amazing. Yeah, I mean, it was this venue in Georgetown in Washington, D.C. called the Bayou, where a lot of those shows went and held about maybe 600 people. And it was, you know, they would sell out. It was fantastic, you know.
But does it now seem really strange to think like that was actually 30 years ago? Because often I remember getting into more extreme stuff in 87, 88, let's say, and Kill 'Em All seemed like it was ancient, and it was 83, and it was 87 or 88, you know, and it seemed like a long time ago. But like now, of course, 1970 is closer to And Justice for All than we are.
Yeah, it's crazy.
Period.
I think that, you know, your relationship with time as you grow older, of course, shifts and changes, because the more experience you get behind you, the more it, the less things seem new and the more things get ordinary, I think. And of course, when you've only been alive for like 16 years on the planet, when you look back, it's something from the perspective of 1990 to 1974. That's ancient history, you know, because it's before you were born.
Yeah.
It's like this, you know, that's like, but to think about now, like 16 years ago is, you know, 2004.
Yeah.
Or 2005. And it's like, it's still a lifetime ago, but you don't have that same, the same perspective. The perspective is totally different because, you know,
to have that perspective, we'd have to be half as old as we are, I suppose. You'd have to be 22, I suppose, or 21 or something. And that's when you talk to somebody who's 19 or 20 now, and then you realize, oh, like, okay, so in 2010, you were 9 years old or something. And, you know, when you play with some young guys, and you realize, oh, right, okay. So I was 9 in 1980, 3 or 4 or something like that, you know. I suppose that's true. That's the length of time is relative to how many years you've spent on the planet. But it still seems crazy that... Let's call it the golden age of death metal.
I did a podcast about this
like 20 podcasts ago. I mean, of course, there's still great death metal bands now, but the golden age is 30 years ago. it seems to be such a young man's game when you think about it. All those bands were raging and they were all in their early to mid 20s. Do you think it's still possible to make death metal that vital when you, you know, approach, you're hitting the 50 mark?
Maybe for us, or for, you know, for those who, us who play death metal or whatever kind of, you know, music we're doing, it's, if it's vital for you, that's all that matters. But I think the music, we also have to remember this music is always, I think, for, it's all about, for, it's really tied up in youth and adolescence, and it's music for those who are getting it now, that it's their time.
Yeah.
You know, that's, this is something Alex Webster said to me, actually, when I was talking to him for the book. He said, you know, this, always have to remember, it doesn't matter, like, our perspective is like what it is, but carrying the flag forward, like kids getting into it today, and it's new to them, it's fresh to their ears, you know, and it's like, and they're going to take it and do what they will with it. And it's really cool to see how some of the younger bands are, you know, kind of like looking back and respect, you know, showing respect and like channeling like a lot of the vibe and sounds from that golden era.
Yeah.
And it's still very much alive more than ever today. So it's, that's really cool to see.
I mean, I have some notes here. We're going to do some sort of, I suppose, favorite things or three things of this, that, and the other. But even when I was just today flicking through the vinyls and just doing a little bit of nerding out on the year 1991, I mean, the list of albums that come out that year is, it's outrageous. I mean,
yeah, yeah.
You know, it's just even here on the page, I've got From Beyond, Massacre, Ten Commandments, Malevolent Creation, Soulside, Journey, Grave, Into the Grave, Human, Blessed Are the Sick, Clandestine, Dismember Like an Overflowing Stream, Mental yeah. Funeral, Where No Life Dwells, Dawn of Possession, War yeah, Master, Butchered at Birth, Morgoth Cursed, Asphyx. And that's before we even get to like Demolich, Pertinence, Gorguts, Massacre, even Sarcophago weighed in. You know, it's just, the list is, it's just outrageous looking back on it. You know, I mean, there's yeah. at least 50 records there that, you know, would have belt, you know, bent my fucking brain back in 1991, trying to get hold of, waiting for them to come into the shop and, oh God, fucking Shadows of the Past Sentenced to come in or whatever, you know, but it is insane. It's insane.
Yeah, I mean, every weekend you could go to the shop and there was something new, and it was just such a vibrant time, man, because like, even all those albums you named are so unique in their own sound.
Yeah.
And their own like expression and voice of like what they were doing. You know, I mean, I guess it wasn't till like the second kind of wave came when you started getting more of the, you know, the similarities and the kind of clones and stuff. But that, I think that's why 1991 is a key year, because that, just that list there alone, you know, just the sheer diversity among every release that was coming up. You know.
Yeah, I mean, and for me, like as a kid who was always had half an eye on, like in 1989, 1990 tape trading, I had already got like Master's Hammer, Rotten Christ, Satanus, Tedium, and there were rumblings of Beherit, and I was always drawn more to that nasty kind of evil stuff, but the rumblings of black metal were in the background. But by 92, it was about to like clobber a lot of death metal on the head for me, in a way, not meant, in a way that death metal became two shorts on MTV, songs about the environment. But by 91, it was still vital. But almost by end of 92, my listening taste had shifted.
Thrash metal.
Say death metal in 91 had become to be MTV-ized and a bit, I didn't like the whole enviro-eco stuff. And I wanted my evil back in death metal. So when black metal came along, especially, it was already rumbling away in 1990, 1991. Mm. And I'd started to divide my loyalty between the two. But by 92, I really stepped more into the black metal thing. But 91 is like the perfect moment for it, for death metal.
Yeah.
But the rumblings of black metal were kind of, they were in the distance. They were moving across the horizon. But I don't know if that was the same for you, but the list of these records is kind of outrageous. I mean, Death Forever magazine, I don't know, they had a top 30 or top 100, of course, or 100 and something. And they had From Beyond listed as the best their best journalists, you know, pooled record of 1991.
That's a good one. I'm not going to say it's wrong, but I mean, I guess, you know, because the issue with that record for me is it took so long to come out. I mean, if it came out when it should have, yeah, like in 87 or, you know, when that that lineup was set.
Yeah.
But as we know, like they had a little detour. Some of the guys had a detour with Death, you know, a very awesome one.
Yeah.
And by the time, you know, they got Cam, I guess, and got around to recording that record, which is still killer and awesome. But I kind of like, even when it came out, I kind of didn't give it the maybe the time I should have or whatever, because I felt like, ah, this is kind of like Death Light in a sense. This is like, this kind of reminds me a lot of the stuff that was happening. The Death is already ground, they've already tread and stuff. And
yeah,
I love Cam Lee's vocals and saw immediately how influential they were for like Barney and
yeah.
But
such a gap between the Chamber of Ages demo and then when From Beyond came out. I mean, that's almost 5 years.
Exactly.
Yeah, so like if From Beyond had been in 88, 89, you know, it probably would have set the stage for them to be even bigger. But I did see them that year with Immolation and Morgoth in Dublin. I don't know, did you see them at the time?
No. I didn't see, I don't know if that tour came through our area, but I know that, that European tour I've seen, there's actually, I think, a video on YouTube from the Dublin show.
Oh yeah?
Massacre, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. It was Devastation were supposed to be on it. Texas Devastation, I think. And they were replaced by Immolation. And at the time in 1991, when that show came through, I don't think we'd ever seen a band playing as fast as Immolation for Dawn of Possession. It was outrageous to see bands playing like literally, you know, that fast. We'd seen some things, but not quite that brutal.
Yeah, I remember like did you see the tour there where Death Play Without Chuck, I think it was, or
I saw that with Creator.
All right.
Yeah.
Is that 91 as well?
That's 1990. It's Coma Souls.
Right.
It was weird. It was a huge crowd in Dublin. It was like over 1,000 people. And Death came out with a guy called Walter Thrashler or something on guitar.
Yeah, from Devastation.
Yeah, he was in Rotting Corpse as well. Maybe he's from Devastation, I'm not sure. And then some dude,
the roadie of Devastation sang for them, maybe.
Yeah, and he didn't have a death metal voice, really. And then the other two, and they just played their way through the first album mainly, and then just spent most of the time insulting Chuck for not being there and stuff.
Yeah, it was a rough time.
Mm. So let's have a, like, what's your, okay, so that, if we're going to do this like nerdy stuff, like nerdy best of, which really appeals to me because I'm a super list nerd. What's in your opinion the best death metal album then of 1991?
Well, I kind of, you know, being an East Coast, you know, in the US, for me, I was really attracted to the brutal stuff.
Okay.
I was on a constant quest to find the more brutal kind of thing. And I really gravitated towards the New York death metal stuff. I was really into Suffocation, Baphomet, Upstate, and that kind of stuff. And the other bands in New York, like Pyrexia. And
yeah.
That scene was like really the core of like just this crushing, pummeling death metal. So for me, Effigy the Forgotten would probably be for that year. Although I was a huge Bolt Thrower fan as well, so Warmaster. And you mentioned, and as far as a surprise release that is also pretty close is Carcass Necroticism.
Yeah, I didn't actually mention that.
that is like such a leap in like, you know, songwriting and production, everything. I love symphonies as well. You know, it's transgressive, like ugly, it's perfect.
So
not expecting Necroticism in any way.
Yeah. Yeah. So if you had three, those Suffocation, Carcass, and...
Yeah, but I mean, it's like you said, off the top of my head, I would lean towards those, but there's so many great releases that year, it's just hard to really narrow it down. But I think the one I probably listened to the most was Effigy the Forgotten.
It's that's strange because I remember the Suffocation...
Butchered of Birth, yeah. I think Butchered of Birth, yeah.
This is the kind of death metal that kind of left me a little bit on the shore, in the sense that I had the Suffocation demo reincremated, I think. And then I bought Human Waste EP when I came out, and I wasn't really sure what to think of it. But I always preferred Immolation and Incantation. Like, I wanted some Satan and some nails and studs. And so the choppy stuff never really, it never, like, Suffocation wouldn't even be in my top 25 of that year. I just I don't get it at all. I get what it is to people, but I don't, it just never resonated with me at all.
I think that's pretty much the first, you know, great divide, if you will, in death metal, maybe.
Yeah.
Because you started to see this development between, on one hand, like perfectionism and refinement, you know, this kind of like Morris Sound Productions, and things are getting really like tight and accentuating the brutal stuff, you know. And on the other hand, there was this sort of like push towards ugliness and rawness and like the Autopsy movement, you know. Well, and
that's
Immolation and Incantation. So you have this, I think that's something that still exists today. It's like this kind of like those who, you know, who, what kind of speaks, what kind of death metal speaks to you? It's usually like on that trajectory.
Well, this is my favorite. This is my favorite of that year.
There you go. I mean, that's, you know, to speak of an album that I had to come back to and I appreciate now, it's that one.
Yeah.
Because, you know, in my narrow vision back then, I started gravitating, and I love those Morris Sound Productions. So when I heard Metal Funeral, it just didn't have the, you know, the balls or the, you know, it wasn't crushing. It was just a different kind of heaviness. It was darker, and it, for whatever reason in my life, it, you know, it didn't, I wasn't gravitating towards that.
It's a really interesting, record. I should have explained that for people that who may be listening to this without visuals. That was Mental Funeral is my top. Just about, but it's my top. But the thing about Mental Funeral is that I loved St. Vitus and Candlemass and Pentagram. Mm. So I was a big Doom head as well. So instantly these Doom riffs just resonated really strongly with me. But it's such an ugly record. And it's dark, and the fact that if you listen to it now, like, the guitars barely have any distortion on them. It's really strange.
I actually listened to that record today in preparation for this, because I wanted to get back and listen to some of those I hadn't really, you know, and I really appreciate it a lot more now.
Yeah, it's weird. Like, it's so clean with a really front-loaded drum sound, but the guitar tone is it's quite small for a death metal record from 1991, considering. You know,
yeah. To me, it's like it has those elements of metal and doom as well as punk. You know, and it kind of, it's just like the anti Morris sound kind of the time. You know, this kind of other. It just shows you how, you know, death metal was moving in these different directions, which became their own subgenres after a while.
Yeah, and it was kind of almost for me, like a reaction to the Cannibal Corpse Suffocation style, which I didn't really like. I liked the fact that I guess I also got a kind of thrill from the fact that I knew death metal people who hated it, because I just thought it was too fucking too slow and stuff. Yeah. But it was the trouble riffs that just got me, the Sabbath-y trouble riffs. But again, it's got some super clean bass sound, which you don't associate with how disgusting the record is.
Yeah, it's like I said, I was kind of trapped in my narrow-minded approach, and I was just seeking things heavy, you know, and getting more and more into that stuff, and which kind of led to when me and John Gallagher started Dying Fetus
in
1991, actually.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, it was 91, was it? Right. Yeah, I was going to get that.
Trying to, you know, following the footsteps of Suffocation and that sort of thing. So it's been a real joy going back and looking at some of these records that I've, I have a much more open mind about now. And
I've been doing it all day, like going back and listening to it. So that was my one. By a pinch, this is my two.
Ah, Blessed Are the Sick.
Yeah.
I think that I would say Morbid Angel might be my all-time favorite death metal band.
Yeah.
Just across, you know, the whole everything, you know, pretty much, you know, up the gateways, I guess.
Yeah.
Like I really like, you know, and...
So
consistent, so much incredible riffs. Just the catalog is it's mind blowing. So
yeah, I mean, I think the last few, notwithstanding, up to Formulas is an absolutely scorching record. I love that record, but those first few, but Blessed at the time, I remember standing in the record shop in Dublin, and Mental Funeral and Blessed Sick came into the shop, I think, on the same day. And everyone, didn't have enough money to buy both, so you were trying to weigh up which one to buy. But I remember standing there listening to it in the record shop, and I said to my friend, fucking Thy Kingdom Come, that's from the demo. My mate just looked at me and he goes, what are you talking about? It was one of the moments when I realized, you know, when you're a kid, you don't realize. I was tape trading a lot at the end of, say, 88, 89, 90. And I just assumed it was something everybody was doing. I used to go into the record shop and there was one guy in there who would give me some tapes every weekend. But then I realized, oh, everybody wasn't tape trading and didn't know that this was Thy Kingdom Come demo. And just sort of the things you were doing, you realize, like, oh, most people, you didn't know. All right, you didn't know this was from this. So the whole of side B is obviously demo stuff, which is really strange when you think about it. I think didn't they mean it to be an EP, I think, originally, for side one? But I saw them for that with Unleashed in Dublin, and Johnny Hedlund wasn't allowed into the country. Anders wasn't allowed into the country, so Johnny Hedlund played the drums and sang.
Right, yeah, because he was 17 or something? Or
yeah, he wasn't allowed into Ireland, yeah.
That's interesting that I've also heard, maybe I was listening on another podcast or something, but maybe you've heard something about this. Was Blessed or the Sick, because of the production, was it somehow instrumental in the backlash from like some of the bands in Norway and Sweden that kind of like they didn't like the production, that sort of like,
I'm not sure. I mean,
a different direction or.
I'm not sure. I mean, as a black metal sort of, you know, halfway house for me, I always stayed with Morbid Angel because they had the satanic themes. And like Covenant was a record that still resonated very strongly with me at a time when death metal wasn't as interesting. And that's only 2 years away from this. It's 93, I guess. Yeah. But the production is, the drum sound is much more modern. What you mentioned in your messages before this, and I was thinking about this the other day, is that it's interesting that Morbid Angel used Tom Morris and not Scott Burns. It seems to have been a sort of quite a wise decision, maybe.
Yeah, I mean, I've found that some people find the production of that record divisive. They find it, you know, kind of processed and thin, and say it's like probably the worst. They've called it the worst production they had, and I didn't ever think about it in those terms. I guess I thought more in terms of riffs. Then, if I like the riffs, you know, and it sounded heavy, then I didn't worry about the details. But
I could see what people mean a little bit about the drum sound being a small bit processed, and maybe being a bit overbearing. But I mean, the songs are so good, you can't really argue with, you know, you can't argue with Day of Suffering and the Blessed Are the Sick, Fall from Grace. I mean, it's huge sounding, you know. But that opening of Fall from Grace with the snare is really on top somehow.
Yeah, it's a ripper. Jeez.
And this is my third of that, if I had top three, was Dawn of Possession.
Yeah, I listened to that today as well. Hadn't listened to it in forever.
And all of these little flyers that I've got stuck to the back of the record. They won't remove or I'll rip it. But yeah, Immolation. The thing about Immolation is that, I mean, probably Immolation is for me the consistently over the length of time, arguably the greatest death metal band of all time, in the sense that they've never made a record I dislike. I mean, maybe Harnessing Ruin is a time where I'm not that excited-ish, but the last few, Atonement, absolutely brilliant.
I really like Close to a World Below.
Yeah, of course.
That one really, yeah.
But the last one is crushing, I think. Atonement is incredible.
Yeah, they're solid and reliable and great songwriters and legends.
Yeah, I mean, and the weird thing about it is like it's Harris Johns.
That's great. Harris did that. I actually tried to, for the book, I tried to talk to him about that. He just didn't really remember much from a lot of these sessions. So
I met him once. I met him once.
He's kind of an old hippie, rocking hippie kind of guy, and you know.
Yeah, I met him once backstage at something or other, and I wanted to ask him about Voivod and Sodom, and he was just like, he's just like, oh, I don't know. He just didn't. I was trying to mine him for stories and ask him about stuff. He just wasn't really very interested.
Exactly. Yeah, I had the same experience. We sat down for a beer. We were playing in Berlin one time and walked across town and had a friend of mine, mutual friend, had us meet. And I was, you know, I was like starry. I, you know, the legend, Harris John, his name's on all the great records, you know, from the 80s, Voivod.
Yeah.
You know, the old Halloween creator, Coroner, just, you know, and I sat down and, you know, asked him about, because, you know, the book was about death metal. So I was kind of trying to mine him for some stories about some of the death metal stuff he did and how, what he thought about it. You know, notably, I think he did Consuming Impulse.
Yeah, that's true. And, yeah.
And Dawn of Possession.
Yeah.
And he did a Protector record, I think, later on.
Golem, maybe.
Shedding of Skin.
I think. Oh, okay. Yeah, 1990 record, yeah.
Yeah, but he just the years are, you know, the years have gone by and things, other things have come into play. And I'm guilty of that as well. I mean, sometimes it's hard to remember the details. You know, you're at this 30-year mark.
I'm a bit sort of like, maybe it's mildly on the spectrum or something like this. But I can remember probably the price I paid the shop, if I thought about it, probably the month of, if you pull, take on my recollection and go, if you said to me, where did you get this from? Grave 7-inch. I would give me a minute or two and I'll be able to go, okay, I got this at a record fair in 19, blah, blah, blah. And I paid this and that and the other. Like I have a kind of, ridiculously sort of not quite photographic, maybe mildly autistic memory for remembering 1988
meaningful events in one's life. So
well, but metal, but metal is often defined by such nerdism in a sense. Like,
yeah.
I've had friends who aren't into rock or metal or anything like this, who would, you know, come down here and they're just like, Jesus Christ! I mean, I can't turn this stuff around, but just all this just covered in records and stuff, and they'd be like, what the? Because it's such kind of like obsessive compulsive nerdist behavior, and I don't mean that in a patronizing way, I mean it like the idea of collecting everything and knowing, okay, you're 1987, you got this for $2.95 and all this kind of stuff. And a lot of people think that, is it only metal that has that sort of devoted feeling of being this sort of avid collector of numbers? Like, because I'm quite obsessed with the numbers and the statistics and all this kind of stuff. And how long you've been into something seems very important to metalheads, that maybe it doesn't seem so in other kinds of music. I don't know. Sorry, I've thrown like six different questions at you there.
No, I think you're correct. I mean, people who are into metal are very passionate about it. It's without a doubt. It's, you know, something which, it resonates and, you know, we're drawn to and attracts to it, most of us at a very young age, and we become lifelong fans. And it's something we take as part of our identity. And, you know, the record collecting, of course, has been around as long as records. And there are those who like different genres and collect records. But there's something about this, you know, this is something also, I think, that goes back to what was special about the tape trading stuff. And the whole analog culture around it, about tape trading, the fanzines, a very tangible aspect of the culture and of the metals, the international metal underground, you know, as an imagined community, to use, you know, an academic term,
yeah,
was very bound up in that kind of media and the way, you know, because, you know, you just had this idea of what was happening over in, you know, Stockholm or in Tampa or some other place. And you just create this whole mythology in your head about it. And you know, yeah, when you got a tape, a letter in the mail from someone from those places or a tape, it was very much a very tangible kind of thing that bound it all together. So I think that's kind of like where it all began for me, you know, like just coming home from work back then and just open up the mailbox and there'd be a stack of 10 letters from 10 different countries.
Yeah, yeah.
that just drew me in. It was just, you know, like, it was just the internationalism of it. Like, and then,
yeah, it sounds like a cliche, but it was totally magical. And it sounds like a cliche when you tell people now, but coming home and, yeah, you're right, finding the mailbox full with tape trading cassettes and all that kind of thing.
Yeah, I just don't know if it could ever be like that again, of course, because of the way communication is now. But that's the kind of, I think that metal in the 1980s and up until like 91 and what we're talking about here was very much wrapped up in that mythology and mystique of it all. And that's kind of what draws you in and gets you hooked. Mm. And ever since then, we're kind of like, as we grow old, we still feel bound to that in a special way, you know, and we want to collect stuff from that time. And of course, part of it is just like any kind of old nostalgia people have, but when you've lived through that time and it's, you know, it was such a, you know, a glorious time, to quote the late Brian Pattison, it was just, you know, it's something that comes to define your whole life in a way.
Yeah.
Like, you know, as it has for us, you know, we went on to play in bands and stuff, and when you go on tour and you actually meet those people you used to write letters to, you know, later in life, and it's kind of cool.
Yeah, definitely is. It's like some sort of Masonic, you know, kind of structure, heavy metal Mason structure. We show up in Chile, Brazil, and somebody goes, oh, I used to write to you in 1989, 1990. Like, fucking hell. Okay, yeah. So tell me, what's your... I'm looking at this list here. Sorry for... What do you think is the most... what do you think of as an underrated album from this time?
Underrated? I mean, about all the ones you name, I don't know if there's any that are so underrated. But I know ones that, because you picked the 1991 year. So mm-hmm. I know some that are in and around that, which I always thought were underrated. But I.
Yeah, okay. We'll throw them out and I'll tell you what mine is. Oh, will I tell you what mine is? Mine is Tiamat, The Astral Sleep.
Okay. Yeah, I never really listened to them.
Well, again, this is one of my favorite 7 inches.
Yeah.
Tiamat, A Winter Shadow. Tiamat is like one of the...
Sure, Treblinka, or was that someone else?
Yeah. Treblinka before that, yeah. That's one of the most important albums, I guess, for Primordial or something. That it had this dark element that was lifted from Into the Pandemonium, but straddled between black metal and death metal, a bit like Samael at the time and Rotting Christ. But Tiamat, The Astral Sleep, I have written down. I have Sentence, Shadows of the Past, I thought was a great record that didn't get much respect at the time.
Yeah, that was on, who put that out? That
French,
was on
an indie. French label, Sedex or something, or.
Yeah, so that definitely didn't get any distribution in the US. I think the Rotting Ways of Misery demo came out in 91 though.
Yeah.
The demo came out the same.
Sorry, I've tried to disappear to find that 7-inch, but that looks a bit weird. Sentence were a fucking great band. The Running Ways of Misery, Journey to Poyola, the demo before North From Here, blew my mind at the time because they were moving into that sort of Iron Maiden. And I think Sentence don't get the respect for bringing in that twin guitar, a bit of Maiden and stuff, like the kind of thing at Dissection. Also ended up doing Sentence
for, well, certainly by North From Here.
It's I think it's a brilliant record, and it's doesn't quite get the respect it deserved for being a kind of proto Maiden death metal melodic kind of record. But certainly Shadow of the Past I thought was a fucking great record.
Yeah, definitely North From Here too. That came out on Spine Farm in Finland, so I don't think that one had distribution widely either. But I guess they made up for it when they went on to Century Media and did pretty well.
Yeah, I mean, there's that whole Finnish scene, Demigod, Demolich, Pertinence, Convulse, Funebra. There's so much, or Funebra Swedish? No, I think they're children.
Yeah, they're from Finland.
Finnish, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, Abhorrence, of course.
Abhorrence, yeah. It never quite grabbed me as much as the Mara Sound and Stockholm scenes, but
it's amazing how like a lot of the younger bands today like really fetishize or, you know, really are drawn to that Finnish sound. Yeah. Like a lot of younger bands, especially Demolik, have become so influential.
Yeah.
Like this new wave of underground bands in the US. But yeah, as far as I do know, my most disappointing record of the year.
Okay,
true. This is very divisive.
Give me that.
I was never one who really liked or bought into Clandestine.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. I loved Left Hand Path to Death. I think that might be my single. It's definitely in my top five all time.
Yeah.
That to me is like a perfect death metal record. And I've had this kind of debate with people before, but I mean the Clandestine to me is totally killed by the vocals.
Yeah. Well, that's Nicky Anderson singing, right?
Yeah. It just, it doesn't, you know, it has this kind of, it's this kind of, you know, yell or whatever, this yelling, or I don't know. Yeah. It just wasn't for me, and it wasn't what I expected. And still to this day, I still have a hard, I always go back to it every now and then and trying, because the riffs are great. I love the production.
Yeah.
But I just can't get over that. So that's certainly, that was kind of, I remember back then I was pretty disappointed with that.
I have to admit, I love it, but I do prefer Left Hand Path, but I love it. But I do know what you mean. I was quite surprised at the vocals as well. And then I think there was a video for Stranger Eons was on MTV a lot.
Yeah. And
they said it was the guy from Carnage, Johnny Dordevic or something.
Yeah, the bass player, I think.
But it didn't, it wasn't him at all, though, was it? It was Nicky just doing it, and then they just decided to put this dude up front.
Yeah, there's so many stories I've heard about who actually, like, I think even on there's another EP where...
But there's the Crawl EP with the guy from Nirvana.
Yeah, and there's... The Stranger Eons EP,
yeah,
also has different vocals on it.
Maybe he did sing on that then, actually. I haven't listened to that in a long time.
But yeah, that was kind of a letdown. But you know, as I said earlier, I was kind of gravitating towards the more brutal stuff, and that was that, unfortunately. But
well, I mean, I find personally, despite what you. I'd have to disagree, and this is like pretty contentious, but I always found Necroticism overrated.
Like, yeah.
I know that's almost sacrilegious, but there was just something about maybe not Necroticism, but Heartwork and stuff. I guess at the time, because I was listening to a lot of Merciful Fate, Manowar, a lot of traditional heavy metal, something rankled with me that Heartwork seemed to be an album that death metal fans who didn't understand or like heavy metal anymore listened to. But then I'd be listening to it going, well, you could just listen to heavy metal with the same sort of riffs. And there was just something about it that I just didn't quite get. I saw Carcass in 92, but Necroticism always for me seemed a little bit, like I like it, but a little bit overrated. But I know that's probably sacrilegious, you know?
Yeah, I could see that. I mean, I liked it. I thought it was okay. I thought it was fun, you know, which probably death metal isn't supposed to be, maybe.
Which, Necroticism or Heartwork?
Heartwork.
Yeah.
I liked some parts of it, but I was, you know, I was kind of moving away from that style at that point.
But said, Necroticism yeah.
I still like, and I just thought it was Necroticism in particular. Like, as I mentioned before, it's like they, you know, they went into somewhere I never thought they would go, and they just refined everything. And
yeah.
The riffs were there, and that was killer.
I think it's one of those records that I undeniably know is good, but somehow it just sort of left me a little bit on the shore. Maybe it's because you're young and you're a pain in the arse, and because everyone else loved it so much, I had to be the kind of pedantic kid who was just like, no, I prefer.
Did you like symphonies?
Yeah, ish, but I mean, grindcore sort of. Wasn't kind of started and ended with World Downfall for me. Yeah. And at the time, that whole, like, I don't like Benediction. I didn't like
the whole Peaceville kind of stuff then.
Peaceville I liked, yeah sure, but the whole Napalm, I know, was never, I liked Scum and From Enslavement to Liberation, but symphonies, I have to admit, at the time I was just more into Morbid Angel and Evil stuff than swampy, grindy, you know, kind of low-tuned sort of stuff. But it must have had a pretty good, huge impact on you, though, Carcass, right?
Yeah, I actually saw them in 1990. I think it was a Symphonies of Sickness tour. Technically, for them, it was in the U.S. opening for Death.
Oh, yeah.
A spiritual healing tour. And I'd heard them earlier that year. I think the first time I'd actually heard them was like on one of those, you know, Grind Crusher comps or something.
Yeah,
that
yeah.
came out, Year 8 comps. And it immediately got the record and was just like, I'd never heard anything like it before. Just the black. I don't think, I mean, of course I heard, because around the same time I heard Terrorizer. So I was just hearing all this like new ways to use the blast beat and
yeah.
you know, pushing the sonic boundaries of what's possible with music kind of thing. And I was standing right on the side of the stage and watching them, you know, three piece up there. It was back when Jeff had the two microphones. Like he had one with a pitch shifter and like one with a regular or something. And yeah, they just got up there and killed it. And then Death came on. And that was just a revelation, man. First time I'd seen them.
Yeah, the first time I saw Death was 92 for Human with Paul Masvidal and I think Sean Reinhart. And I'm not sure can't remember who was playing the bass, but it was Human. And they arrived late they missed the ferry across, most bands would have to come across in the ferry to Dublin. They missed the ferry and there was like, Death were supposed to play two nights and they canceled the first night. And so everybody from the first night showed up to the second night with their tickets and they over pushed the venue by 300 people, 250 people. So it was mayhem inside. And then the band arrived late. And Loud Blast were supporting. We're supposed to get Pestilence. They didn't come. Loud Blast came and played four songs and Death played eight songs. And I never forget it Death, just about 2 minutes into the first song, this kid jumped off the very high speaker, came straight through the crowd in front of me and put his leg through the floor, like straight through the floor, broke his leg, I guess, straight to the floor. They pulled this kid out and then four security guards had to stand with their arms linked in the middle of the pit of an oversold venue of 200-300 people, holding to stop people from going in the hole in the ground, just fucking hitting people.
No,
it's in a venue called McGonagall's.
McGonagall's,
Which was closed.
Sorry. Flyer here. I got this bolt thrower flyer from McGonagall's from back in the day.
Oh yeah, black and white one with a kind of dude with the gum sort of written on it. Yeah,
somewhere around here.
Yeah, McGonagall's bolt thrower played in McGonagall's in 1988 with Carcass and Electro Hippies on a Saturday afternoon for like £1, like a punk rock show. But and then Death played and they played eight songs. Chuck didn't say anything to the crowd. Stared out over the crowd. It was very weird for us to see. Like, they didn't look like a death metal band at all. They were brilliant, but like it was really strange stand up. Like they weren't engaging with the crowd at all. And then afterwards, you'd expect a band like that to not come out and talk to people, but they were out. Like Chuck was just standing in the hallway of the venue talking to people. And we were, I remember we asked him, I said, "Oh, do you like Immolation and all this stuff?" And he was just like, no, of course not. And then this girl came up to him and said, "Why didn't you play a longer set? Blah, 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 blah." And he just took a look at her and he went, "Bitch, change your tampon." And we were kids. We were like, what? We were 16, like, wow. Okay. That was a bit.
Dude.
That was a bit weird. Yeah, he was sort of friendly with us, but kind of not friendly. But, yeah.
Yeah, as you know, like, you never know, like, what goes on. It kind of had a... Anything could happen on that ferry. Anything could happen when you're on the shitty monitors also, you know, it's like make you feel like smashing your shit and walking off stage, but you just got to go through with it, you know?
But yeah, that's weird. No, I don't know. I mean, I liked Carcass, but I always thought it was a little bit. The sort of, maybe it was just the fact that it was just so popular and I was just being cantankerous and I was just like, no, I prefer Rotting Christ, Passage to Arturo, or whatever, you know. But I have a few. So, what was the best show you saw that year?
It might have been Cannibal Corpse and Gore Guts.
Really?
Yeah, we used to have this place in Maryland called Wilmer's Park. It was this old, like, kind of run down, like, I don't know, speakeasy kind of bar in the middle of a field in the countryside outside Washington, D.C. It was an old, like, Chitlin Circuit bar, which was like when the old R&B bands would tour around for black audiences. There would be like a special venue for that.
Yeah.
But when the owner started just like letting any kind of shows happen there, and by the late 1980s, he started doing metal shows there. And it was infamous because it was a place we can go and drink underage. They would serve, like, you know, high school kids there, anybody.
Yeah,
so we just go there to see anybody. I remember I got my first mosh pit there to a band called Wrathchild America.
Oh, yeah.
Well, the Wrathchild America were the quite different from Wrathchild UK.
Yeah, yeah.
A little bit different. But and they were like kind of like our Maryland's contribution to the, you know, late contribution to the thrash kind of thing. But anyways, that was like one of my first shows there with where I actually moshed and fell down and got kicked in the head and all that.
Yeah.
I think it was in January of 1991. There was a tour, the Butcher to Birth tour was launched. It might have been later, I'm not sure. And it was Cannibal Corpse, Atheist, and Gore Guts.
Wow.
It was the second show of the tour. I know that because the night before the tour started in New York, and for whatever reason, Atheist didn't make the show, and it was just Gore Guts. Deceased, local band, were local to us.
Yeah.
They opened the show, and Gore Guts played, and Cannibal Corpse played, Butcher to Birth. And just the whole wild, I don't know, atmosphere of this place, because like, it wasn't police. You could just tell like everything was kind of on edge. There was no like, you know, it wasn't like this controlled security guard kind of bullshit you get like in some places these days where, you know, it was just anything goes, no barrier, everything's on stage, like shit's getting kicked over, you know, bottles flying against the wall. And it was magical in all its chaos. And I remember the ceiling was like really low. And when Alex Webster was like doing his head spins, his hair got caught in the ceiling tiles.
Yeah.
So he's like standing there like this, like playing at the same time. But anyways, that was phenomenal. You know, I got to see Gore Guts for the first time, and I love Considered Dead. That's like another one of my favorites from that year.
That's a weird record that kind of didn't register with me at all. It didn't land at all. That I actually like more now than I did. But that's because I sort of fell in love with Gore Guts from the new Gore Guts. I love the last few Obscura and Colored Sands and
yeah.
Play Days Dust. One of my favorite things from the last couple of years, probably because it somehow sounds like death metal, Death Spell Omega.
Yeah, yeah.
I love what Gore Guts are now, but back then I was just like, ugh. I guess part of me was like Gore Guts. And I just, all that kind of thing, it's just no. I mean, it's not really much different to a rotting Christ, but or septic.
Yeah, but the gore and the guts was definitely its own thing. And I could see again, you know, we can see again where that kind of divide was happening.
Yeah.
You know, towards the darker side of death metal and the more like I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I was looking through some of the, I was trying to find my favorite 7-inch of the year, and like that would have been Incantation. Unleashed and the Laughter Has Died. This, which is Dismember, Skin Her Alive, nice. Grave, yeah. Yamat. It's all a bit darker stuff, you know, the stuff never, it didn't really do it for me. But that must have been your bag then, because then you went on, like you mentioned earlier, to do start the Dying Fetus then, you know?
Yeah, that's, you know, like that we really gravitated towards the New York scene at that time. And the New York scene, like, came out into the mid 90s. And that was an interesting time, you know, because death metal was, you know, it went back underground again for the most part. By 1995, I remember going to see Malevolent Creation in Baltimore. They had Forbidden opening up for them.
Oh, that's weird.
And there was like 10 people there, you know, nobody cared. It was back underground. And that's when bands started pushing the boundaries in other ways. But I mean, it was interesting because I've often had this kind of like, you know, theory about how, you know, death metal kind of emerged in the late, in the context of late 1980s, you know, this kind of like, you know, the, it came out of naturally out of punk and metal sort of in a way. And at the time, you know, it's like Cold War, it's like 80s excess, it's like Reaganism, Thatcherism.
Yeah.
You know, it just seemed like it kind of culminated in this kind of like late 80s, like explosion of like, you know, what it was heading towards all along,
yeah,
in a sense. But then if you take this broader kind of like weird, like this weird kind of economic theory I have about it.
Okay.
Like when times are like that and you have those kind of tense moments in culture, that's when transgressive music kind of pushes the boundaries and starts expanding and like thriving in a way. So that after the Cold War and in the United States, you know, you got Bill Clinton coming in and there's this new kind of era of a new cultural, you know, structure of feeling, if you will, which kind of, you know, it has an effect on culture in the sense that maybe the expression for death metal, like you said, even in Ireland, this kind of like new culture of like ecstasy culture came about, and in the US grunge came about and all this other stuff where like extreme music felt like it reached this kind of like a pinnacle or threshold or whatever, where it did what it could. And then it went off and fragmented into all these subgenres, you know, death, doom, black death and atmospheric and all these other things were being tried. And
I think you have
it went back underground again for the 90s. So
I think you have a point. I think about it. I thought about that kind of quite a lot, but what I think is maybe that post 1990, you have the fall of the Berlin Wall and you have a kind of shifting in the axis of the power structures of the West. And I think that there was an economic sort of revival in the early 90s. So you have the birth of this new emergent middle class. And so I think that the music that they liked and that reflected in their tastes, I mean, if you look at the biggest heavy metal bands in the end of the 90s, early 2000s, it's all symphonic, gothic, female-fronted, slushy sort of stuff with no teeth or claws compared to 1986, which was still music metal. Okay, you have your Dios and your Priests, but bands who are quite aggressive sort of speak to an aggressive time. And I think by 96, maybe that society has changed. Certainly in Ireland, Ireland was rough as guts in the 80s, but by 96, it was in the middle of an economic revival. And society changed. I mean, everything from the violence on the streets to people's attitudes. The birth of this new emergent middle class definitely altered our relationship, I think, to aggressive music.
Exactly.
And that's maybe where you get your Dimmu Borgirs and your also this other kind of stuff maybe becomes popular at the end of the 90s, because it's no longer the preserve of, I don't know, 300 angry young men in a venue beating the shit out of each other to you know.
Exactly.
Definitely that 87, 86, 88 thrash is about as aggressive as it can possibly get. Still probably
Persecution Mania.
Yeah. Pleasure to Kill. Yeah, all that kind of stuff. Because I mean, living on the Essen in 86 in the Ruhr industrial area of Germany was no, you know, it was no economic miracle either. And I think that was a lot of places, and I suppose it's reflected in the music. So I think there's something in your theory. Definitely the emergent middle class has some part of how their listening tastes changed, and I think it is metal went underground quite considerably.
Yeah, and just the disappearance of the nuclear threat to, you know, temporarily, it wasn't as you know, stark as it was in the 80s.
Yeah.
And if you follow that trajectory, you know, by the time you get up to the, you know, 2000 and then 9/11 and this war on terror, and there's this kind of new tension in American culture where metal all of a sudden is thriving again.
Yeah.
You know, and I don't know, it's just something I've always kind of wondered about why there was that kind of, you know, that fizzling out of death metal. It reached that apex or whatever, and then it kind of like plateaued.
But then it kind of came back around the early 2000s. I mean, the success of bands like Nile, Cryptopsy in the USA, they were selling 20, 30, 40,000 units probably in the USA. At least I heard in the early to mid 2000s. And then it almost entirely collapsed.
Well, the thing was like with nu metal, I think that provided a gateway for people to get into more heavier stuff. From that, it went to Slipknot to other more extreme bands, you know, and that's when there was that kind of resurgence. But in the same time, it kind of mainstreamized it. So now people in mass culture know what death metal is. They may not listen to it, but they know death metal, and there are death metal bands, and, you know, there's references, cultural references for it. So that creates a kind of new, like, it kind of blurs the lines between, you know, underground death metal and mainstream death metal. What is mainstream anymore? What isn't? Because they're all, you know,
but you know, platforms. You know what I mean? Like, there was a moment around 2004, 2005 where anecdotally I heard that, you know, like a lot of those bands were touring the States and doing really good numbers. But now it's the last 3 or 4 or 5 years. If you sent out Cryptopsy on tour or something, that sort of bubble had long, long since burst. I don't know about that, but I've certainly heard anecdotally some horror shows from people I know who went over and toured the US in the last couple of years, Vader and stuff about, you know.
Yeah, it goes in waves, you know. It's, you know, these are the ebbs and flows of culture and how they, you know, the economy as well hasn't been that great. So
yes, I suppose so.
That, yeah, of course, dictates a lot of it. But and then there's the new questions about what's going to happen with it now with the touring industry. But
wait, that's for another podcast.
Yeah.
So what I have a few more things here, like, but is there an album? Okay, let's say three questions, right? An album, yep, that's, an album that's aged badly, an album that you didn't rate at the time that you do now, and maybe the most surprising album of the time, or something like this. You know, I've got a, they can sort of be wrapped up into the same question. Like, for my didn't rate, oddly enough, I have Soulside Journey, which didn't, for some reason I didn't like at the time, but I like a lot now.
Yeah, same here.
Yeah. The most surprising that blew my mind was Paradise Lost Gothic, that I suppose can still be termed death metal on some grounds, but yeah. Gothic just was, I mean, in Ireland, we really resonated with the miserabilism of My Dying Bride. So My Dying Bride, maybe we're doing Symphonaire around the time. My Dying Bride, all that doom, death,
especially
Paradise Lost Gothic was just, and for me, Gothic is one of the most influential metal records of all time, top 20, 30 of all time. It just, to take the Sisters of Mercy sort of weird, mix it with death metal and the harmony, slow lead over it, has to be the most surprising, along with, well, The Astral Sleep, which I mentioned before. I don't know. What do you think of that?
I remember listening to, it was like they did this, like a video, some videos for one of those songs back then or something. And I saw it, and a friend of mine bought Gothic, and it was cool, but it didn't really grab me. It didn't resonate, you know, for previously noted reasons. It was kind of like, that wasn't where my mind was, but I definitely appreciate it now.
Can you get into like Serenades, or let's say Crestfallen, Anathema, Serenades, Symphonaire, My Dying
All Bride? That stuff I just heard recently, because it was like part of that like avant-garde kind of atmospheric stuff, which I didn't totally get into back then. I was hungry for something with teeth, you know?
Yeah.
I don't know, maybe it's living in Finland the last 3 years, but I've really gravitated towards that, yeah, that Anathema, the old My Dying Bride stuff, you know, I've really gone back to that. And
As the Flower Withers is a massive record. Those first two, Turn Loose the Swans, the Symphonaire EP, As a Flower Withers, are massive. Yeah, very gloomy, very dark. And there was not just those three bands, there was a whole host of all sorts of other north of England doom death bands that were around at the time who were very big here and a very big impact. I think it's a form of miserabilism and bitterness that we shared with all those kind of bands, because most of the Irish bands had that gloom about them as well.
I could totally see it. I appreciate it now, and I wish I appreciated the diversity of it all back then. I mean, I did in a way, but I just didn't give it the time I should have, I guess. And I found other records too from that year too. I think the Pungent Stench
didn't
come out then. That's another one I've kind of like picked up on lately is like really cool and transgressive in its own way, which I kind of missed out on then in my narrow-mindedness.
Yeah, I wasn't that much into that record. I had the split with the Disharmonic Orchestra, I think. And I think Disharmonic Orchestra, that album they made where they were all on the back with fluffy toys.
I forgot about that. Yeah, that's not metal.
It made me actually want to smash their records with a fucking hammer. I hated it.
Yeah.
My black metal soul was hurt.
No.
Yeah. No, I can't have it. But unfortunately, I think Pungent Stench got like pushed into that mentioned by me.
Yeah.
You probably don't belong there. But For God Your Soul For Me Your Flesh was kind of cool.
Yeah, and as far as the one that hasn't held up, I would think what I've listened to lately and it kind of surprised me, even though it's technically proficient, it has some killer riffs and I liked it a lot then, is Testimony of the Ancients.
Yeah, that's, you know, that's weird. I have that like in my scribblings here, my mess of words. The record that didn't hold up, Testimony of the Ancients. Yeah. Doesn't make sense, does it? The silly intros and the...
No, it's like, what is all that about? Just take them all out. It's like, I don't know if you ever heard that Resurrection record with the little, with the troll speaking between every song, whatever.
Oh, Florida Resurrection.
Yeah. It's kind of like that kind of, the, you know, the taking the intro, idea of the intro to like a new level to like link all the songs. And some of the intros are cool. Then there's some of these like weird, like orgy noises in one. And there's another one, which is like a little avant-garde keyboard thing. And then,
yeah.
But as a whole, like I used to love that record back then. And today, like put it side by side with Consuming Impulse. And it's not like, no question.
And I even prefer Malleus Maleficarum personally.
Yeah, I know a lot of people who do. Like that's
another sharp thing. Yeah, the black metal kids prefer Malleus. It's just the razor sharp riffing, you know. But yeah, the Testimony, also you miss Martin's voice. One of the top five, top 10 death metal vocals of all time, gotta be Martin. And you miss his horrendous vocals on Consuming Impulse are just part of the tone, you know.
He made up for it though, because another one of my top five or top 10, it might be his Last One on Earth by Sphyx.
Oh yeah.
That is just a tank.
It's a crusher, yeah. Bismarck and...
Really?
Yeah.
Sounds like he's literally dying.
Well, I mean, The Rack is 91 as well.
Yeah. I like that too. But for some reason, Last One on Earth, they kicked it up a notch. It's a little more driving.
And the new one is cool as well. Still at it. But I agree with you. I have here albums that aged with difficulty for me. I used to love it, and it doesn't make sense that I loved it. It's Unquestionable Presence by Atheist. Because I loved the Ravage demo, and then I loved the On They Slay or whatever it was. Then I loved Piece of Time. And I did a fanzine in 1990, and my review of it is like 95 out of 100 Unquestionable Presence. But I tried to listen to it today and I found it fucking hard. That and Cynic with the weird vocal harmonizer thing. It's just, I can't do it.
Yeah, as far as from a production standpoint, that's like one of the best sounding like records. If you know, if good, tight, clean production is your thing, that was a phenomenal production job. Like as far as everything was just, you know, pushing and pummeling the vocals on that record just kind of like fill space. And I mean, the music's cool, the tech is there, and there's some really cool, but sometimes it gets a little too twangy and goofy in spots with these like little doo 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 kind of stuff. And
yeah,
and the vocals have lost that kind of you know, they're extreme vocals, but they don't sound pissed. They don't have this kind of like, I don't know, something.
Yeah.
Something about them just doesn't speak to me about my life.
Yeah, no, it's, you know, I have the same kind of thing. Pestilence, Atheist, Cynic, there's something about them that sort of left me on the shore. I have down here demo 7-inch, 12-inch, but you know what? That's opening up a huge... morass of not of, of tons and tons of names, but I can say without a doubt that the 12-inch thing, like you got Crawl, you got Fiend for Blood, you've got so many good fucking 12-inches that time. But Soulside Journey is a weird one because it didn't speak to me much at the time. I remember being in the record store and Soulside Journey in my hand and the Ten Commandments by Malevolent Creation in the other hand, and everything about Soulside Journey is what I should have gravitated towards, the cover, the logo, the everything. And I listened to it and I just put on Multiple Stab Wounds by Malevolent. I was like, no, I'm going for Malevolent.
Yeah.
Which is a classic.
I love the first two Malevolent or Stone. Like, I love Retribution probably even more.
Really?
That's just like, that was right up my alley at the time. The combination of Rob Barrett on guitar and Alex Marquez on drums. Solstice, if you know Solstice from Florida.
Yeah, sure.
Their first record, just like the grooves, everything about it was just like so tight. And as far as like a Soulside Journey, I got a weird feeling from that. I bought it when it came out and I listened to it a few times and I just didn't understand it maybe. I don't know. I just got a vibe from it.
It's a very cold record. It's very dark, very cold.
I didn't know what it was. Yeah. Like, I was like, this sounds like it's Sunlight. It sounds like it should be a death metal record, but maybe they were trying to figure out what they wanted to be because the next record was, you know, but I just, it didn't, you know, but go. Now when I put on Cromlech, I'm like, yes, you know, dude, you know, like, but back then it just went over my head or under my head or whatever. I don't know, but.
And what did you feel? I mean, most people wouldn't even consider this a contest, but I would. I would put Where No Life Dwells up against Like an Ever-Flowing Stream.
In what way? Just like
I think a lot of people would prefer Dismember, but I'm a big Unleashed fan, old Unleashed, and so there's something about Where No Life Dwells and The Dark One and The Laughter Has Died and Where Life.
Yeah, that.
Dark.
The aura, that has an aura, that record, which I and of course For the Creation Time is like, and, but that actually, now that I think about it, that almost has the kind of Autopsy kind of production.
Yeah, but it's Valdemar, isn't it? Valdemar Sorcha. He did a lot of the early Century Media, early 90s stuff, Valdemar, right? Or is Where No Life Dwells isn't Sunlight? Because I remember that was a big thing at the time. They didn't go to Sunlight to do it.
It's like Woodhouse or something?
Woodhouse Studios in Berlin, yeah. And Valdemar Sorcha was the guitar player of the band Despair. Do you remember them? Thrash band, I think.
Yeah.
They had some cool albums. I think that one of the guys from Century Media was actually in Despair as well. But they had Beyond All Reason, was quite a cool album. And Valdemar, he did The Astral Sleep. He did Morgoth Cursed. He did Where No Life Dwells. He did, of course, amazing jobs on Ceremony of Opposites, a male, a few years later, Rotting Christ. Man. Yeah, he did some huge productions. But Where No Life Dwells has a thing that isn't, that's very different to the thing, you know, that stuff going on. So I think it's a very dark record.
Yeah, definitely. I think Unleashed and Grave stood out because they didn't go to Sunlight, right?
Oh, yeah, Grave went somewhere else. Well, quite where? I should have the record here. But I mean, you can see even on the back of the, you know, on the Grave 7-inch, Century Media were signing these bands and then sending them to a studio in Germany, bringing them over to do like one-day sessions. Like that, they went to this as
right.
Bielefeld in Germany. Same with Tiamat, same with some of those bands that they were, I suppose, primed, groomed, I don't know. Came to record a 7-inch in Germany before the main record. But there's something about that those records that, especially Into the Grave, also has a very dark sort of tone.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a big fan of You'll Never See. That's the one that really, where I think is their magnum opus, I guess, if you want to call it that. But
it's quite interesting that those bands already had decided to steer a bit clear of each other, whereas the Florida bands were all going to Morrisound.
Yeah, it was interesting when I talked to Ola about the recording of that. They wrote You'll Never See in the hotel room, like after a tour, before they had to go in the studio.
Yeah.
Yeah, just like really fast, you know, like just threw it all together and went and recorded a record. It's like, And they just come up with that. So, wow.
Still making good records, though.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, both those bands have ups and downs now. But I still buy the new Incantation album, and I still check out what Unleashed and all these bands are doing, especially Immolation and stuff. I mean, they can get a second lease of life, but they seem to all hit a kind of fallow period at the end of the 90s, early 2000s, and come back up.
Yeah, longevity. I mean, it's amazing how, I mean, I never would have thought 30 years later, like, we're still talking about the bands that put out albums through all these years. And it's just, you know, and the consistency, it's still been good. And I think, you know, I think the scene is pretty healthy. You know, I think you asked before about if, you know, is the best metal in the underground now or in the mainstream?
Yeah.
Well, I think it is. It's a little bit of both. There's just so much. I mean, there's like 1,000 bands on Bandcamp. There's like so much, you know, metal being made of all kinds, and so much great death metal that I'm constantly hearing. You know, there's like a new tape label starting every week with, like, you know.
Yeah, there's so much stuff. I find it hard to keep up with. I mean, even when I used to live in the same house as Dara from Invictus, and before he had his own offices, you know, all the stuff would be coming into this spare room, and you just go in and I just go in and stare at the wall and go, fucking, okay, here's 25 CDs that I'm just going to check out to see. But now it's, I still have 20 records, 25 records every year that I really quite like. When I'm asked to do my top 20 at the end of every year, I can do it. I know a lot of people struggle, older, you know, people who are struggle to reconnect with some of the newer bands in the scene. But you're right, there is just so many bands, so many things.
It's a lot of it's really good too. Yeah. So it's just so hard to keep up and find the hours of the day to listen to all this stuff. But I guess, you know, we're not teenagers anymore. But
yeah. So you've started a shop up there. We might as well bookend this thing with that. You started a shop up there. How easy was that to do? Or it's mainly a death grind shop?
Yeah. When I got here about 3 years ago, you know, as I mentioned earlier, there was this kind of niche open here, maybe. You know, Finland is a very metal country. Helsinki's a very metal city. And I noticed, you know, there's a black metal shop here.
Yeah.
Which is pretty much black metal dedicated cult.
Yeah, yeah, by Sami from Thy Serpent, yeah.
Yep. And I was talking to my buddy Petri. You know, we always, you know, as we're talking before, we're record nerds and we love the music, and it's a good excuse to be around music all the time. And we saw an opportunity to, well, there isn't one of these kind of stores here for death metal and extreme, you know, grindcore and hardcore punk and that kind of stuff, then we should try and set one up. And so we started out as kind of an underground thing for like a year or two, in like in this dungeon cellar in this building, where it's like an appointment only kind of thing.
Oh, appointment only. That sounds...
Yeah, on Saturdays, you know, we'd be down there and come down and get some coffee and look at the records. So now, since the pandemic hit, you know, some of us had a little more free time.
Yeah, so tell me about it.
Yeah. You know, there's some open storefront spaces too. So we took a chance and we got a storefront here in Helsinki, Katu 32, in the Kallio district of Helsinki.
Oh yeah.
Take a little look at it real quick.
Oh yeah, yeah, do
it. And there's the records, we got shirts, everything. And it's been going good.
Yeah.
People really like it, really appreciate it. And we have an online component as well. So it's steady.
Cool. That's cool. Right, so before we go, what is then your favorite death metal album of all time?
Of all time, For All Tid.
If you had to pick one.
I would probably say, Harmony Corruption, Napalm Death. That's considered a death metal record.
I made a face when you said that.
That's the one I always kind of grab. That's the one that's like, it just always, it's like going home every time I hear it.
Wow. You know? I bought that record the day it came out, and I sold it about a week later. In Ireland, in Ireland, we used to do this thing called, when you had never had any money for drink or for whatever, but there was huge racks of secondhand records, and it was brilliant at the time in the late 80s, early 90s, because like metal from 83, 84 was 85 was so unpopular by 1990 that you could just find like tons of Venom and all the stuff that we were, you know, kind of stuff that was out the door. But Napalm, I loved Scum, I loved From Enslavement, I loved Mentally Murdered. And then when Harmony Corruption came out, it was really on the wrong side of the fence where death metal was concerned for me. And I just, I wanted Studs and Nails and Satan. And it just...
What's so equal? I mean, that's the one I always like, but I mean, still, I think I could put it on the same, pedestal as Consuming Impulse. You know, War Master, Bolt Thrower, Retribution, Malevolent Creation. Those are kind of like my, you know, the ones that kind of I always think about very fondly.
Well, I'd have to put Altars of Madness. I mean,
that too. You see, I mean, there's just so many. I keep forgetting about them. Yeah, Altars of Madness, Covenant. I mean,
what about, I have to put, I mean, I would say Possess, Seven Churches as well.
Yeah, I think I might be in the camp that doesn't count that as a death metal record.
But but it has a song called Death Metal on it.
It does. So did Onslaught, right?
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
We have was it Onslaught or was it?
No, yeah. Onslaught has a song on Power from Hell called Death Metal. Yeah.
Yeah. I always thought. Yeah. It could very well be. I mean, that to me, I think Dark Angel, Darkness Ascends is almost.
Yeah, almost.
Proto death metal.
Yeah. I mean, when the divisions were only minute, but yeah, Dark Angel, Darkness Ascends is proto. I think it could be considered proto death metal easily. Yeah. Black Thrash, even, and probably what it would have been considered at some stage. Quite whatever that fucking means, I don't know. Well, Harmony Corruption, yeah, all right. There's a
drug. Well, I mean, among many, I would put it on the same pedal. It was just the first thing that popped in my head.
No, it's good. It's good because it's like it's my face was. But that's the thing about this period, though, that there's so many great records. I mean,
how about you? What was yours?
My of all time was Altars of Madness. Push came to shove, it was Altars of Madness. But it's also could be Left Hand Path. Mental Funeral, Seven Churches.
Left Hand Path, of course.
Seven Churches. There's just so, and even the records that I would have considered like first, second division are still 8 out of 10 records. You know, I mean, just looking at the list is insane. Even something like Morgoth Cursed, which, you know, is a lot, it's kind of like death, the German death.
Yeah.
It's a record. Not bad. Not bad at all. If it came out now, people would be all over it, you know. But Sarcophago, The Laws of Scourge is 91. I mean, it doesn't hold a candle to INRI, but if, I don't know, is that death metal, Sarcophago, INRI? If so, that's got to be...
Is Arise death metal?
I don't know. It's sort of not.
Sort of. Yeah, exactly. It's just, it's such on the line. It could be a thrash record just as easily to me.
All right. Well, sir, let me press the button.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.